we find a way to move on and honor their memories by doing what we do.
The four airmen who died in the C-17 crash had distinguished military careers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 30th of July. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Permanent Fund records decent earnings for the fiscal year.
We had an exceptionally good 9 months. The returns for the fund through the end of March were quite good. April was okay. May and June were very weak.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
TransCanada Pipeline says there were multiple bids submitted by potential users of a gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets. In announcing the results of the open season process that closed at the end of business today, TransCanada's Tony Palmer said the bids came from the natural gas industry and they totaled a significant volume. Without giving details, Palmer said the company, working within the state permit granted by the legislature, still must resolve key details of the bids. He said, however, that the company is encouraged by the initial response. The Alaska Air National Guard released the names today of the four crew members who died Wednesday in the C-17 crash on Elmendorf Air Force Base. They were Major Aaron Malone, Major Michael Freyholtz, Master Sergeant Thomas Sicardo, and Air Force Captain Jeffrey Hill. Malone's hometown was Anchorage. Major Guy Hayes is a public affairs officer with the Alaska National Guard.
Major Malone served his country with distinction for 12 years in the Air National Guard, and he's been in the military for quite a few years. He was initially assigned to the Iowa Air National Guard, and he transferred up to Alaska in 2008. To fly the C-17.
Malone was an instructor pilot for the C-17 and a former pilot with Alaska Airlines. Hayes says Major Michael Freyholtz joined the Air Force in 1998.
He's originally from Minnesota, but he left active duty and joined the Alaska Air National Guard in May of 2000 and was the first outside pilot hired for our 249th Airlift Squadron, and he was instrumental in standing it up here in Alaska.
Master Sergeant Thomas Sicardo had been deployed several times to support the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Major Hayes says he had a long military career.
He served with distinction for more than 28 years in the Armed Forces of the United States. And, it's hard to say enough about somebody who served their country and their state for so long. He joined the Alaska Air National Guard in September of 1997, and he had so much experience in the Marines, the Army, and the Air Force Reserve that he was an invaluable asset to our organization.
Sicardo had also saved more than 60 lives working rescue missions with the Guard. Air Force Captain Jeffrey Hill was a C-17 instructor pilot who began his career in 1998. Hayes says he was originally from Pennsylvania.
And he was a gifted aviator, and he's going to be sorely missed here in Alaska for what he brought to the table. He was just a great person and a great individual and better pilot.
Hill loved the outdoors, including hunting, fishing, and hiking, and helped motivate younger airmen to stay fit. He was known around Elmendorf Air Force Base for his infectious smile, great sense of humor, and his positive attitude. Hayes says on base, people are coping with the losses as well as can be expected.
I mean, anytime you deal with something like this, it's difficult, but we find a way to move on and honor their memories by doing what we do, and that's continuing with the mission and serving the United States and the state of Alaska.
The four men died Wednesday when the C-17 cargo plane crashed shortly after taking off on a training mission for this weekend's air show. There will be a memorial for the men at the air show where people are invited to leave flowers. The Alaska Permanent Fund grew nearly 12% during the 2010 fiscal year, which ended on June 30th. KDLG's Adam Kane has this report.
According to the unaudited figures released today by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the Permanent Fund closed the fiscal year with a balance of $33.3 billion, up 11.8%. The actual return was 2% higher than the targeted return, and all but one of the fund's asset classes saw positive returns during the 2010 fiscal year. Michael Burns is the executive director for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. He says that the improvement in the fund signifies a good year overall.
We had an exceptionally good 9 months. The returns for the fund through the end of March were quite good. April was okay. May and June were very weak, but on balance, it was a good year, almost 12% for the fund. These are preliminary numbers, about 11.8 to 12%, which is a very nice comeback from the difficulties the markets had the last couple of years.
The $33.3 billion final balance was counted after the corporation transferred $858 million to the State of Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend Division. That amount is down slightly from the $875 million transfer from the 2009 fiscal year. Much of the growth in the permanent fund this year was attributed to strong returns from the bond assets, which performed considerably better than market benchmark index rates. Because real estate generally takes longer to be valued, the permanent fund's real estate returns have not yet been calculated, and the final amounts probably won't be available until September. Burns suggests that the final amount will probably be nearly flat for the fiscal year, which he says is not a bad place to be.
Real estate markets have gone through some difficult times, although they didn't get as difficult as some people thought they would. And I'm talking about the commercial side, not residential, that we read so much about. And we don't use much leverage with our real estate portfolio, so it's allowed us to be a little bit more selective. And we're in some of the stronger markets. We've got a lot of money invested around Washington, D.C., and it seems to have been pretty much unaffected by the recession. So for better or for worse, government continues to grow and that real estate market continues to be strong.
The permanent fund earned $1.6 billion in statutory income, which is comprised of dividends from stocks, interest, rent, and capital gains that were actually received by the corporation in the 2010 fiscal year. That compares with the negative $2.2 billion experienced in the 2009 fiscal year. Burns says that after the recent recession, the $33.3 billion in the permanent fund is still below the fund's high watermark.
We were almost $40 billion at one point. That's about 4 years ago now. So, and we got down, actually, when in the worst part of the markets, we were down about $26 billion. So, you know, we've come back substantially from there, but not all the way back. But if you're going to compare, you know, where we are today to our high watermark, you have to take out, you know, or add back in the dividends that we've paid. So it's not exactly apples to apples, but your basic question is, are we back to where we were? No, but we're a lot closer than we were a couple of years ago.
On Thursday, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation transferred $858 million to the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend Division. The State Dividend Division is responsible for approving applications and distributing the annual dividend. The corporation's transfer of $875 million in 2009 resulted in approximately $1,300 dividend being distributed to all eligible state residents. The final amount of the 2010 dividend is expected to be announced by the governor's office sometime in September. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Nearly a dozen NOAA scientists are conducting a necropsy today on a 43-foot female humpback whale struck Wednesday by a Princess cruise ship. They're trying to determine if the whale died from the blow or was injured or dead before the Sapphire Princess struck. The carcass was removed Wednesday from the ship's bulbous bow and beached on the backside of Douglas Island in a spot suitable for the necropsy. NOAA spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says a team of marine mammal biologists took preliminary samples yesterday in preparation for today's necropsy. They also measured the whale. Initial observations indicated the whale was a juvenile humpback, but it turned out to be much bigger. Female humpbacks generally measure between 35 and 45 feet in length. Spiegel says NOAA law enforcement officers also have begun their investigation and have a good idea now as to when the Sapphire Princess hit the whale.
According to Princess Cruises in their logbook for the ship, the ship had to increase power at about 1:30 a.m. to maintain speed, and they're thinking that might possibly be the point where they connected with the whale in Chatham Straits.
She says NOAA's law enforcement team has interviewed the ship's captain and some officers and is still in the process of gathering and reviewing evidence. She says today's necropsy team is led by veterinarians from NOAA Fisheries and the Alaska Sea Life Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the lost and found story of a very expensive cruise ship anchor.
They spooled off the anchor and 1,200 feet of chain. And each link of the chain is about 20 inches long and weighs 180 pounds.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The University of Alaska Anchorage has named former State Attorney General Talis Kohlberg as director of its Matsu College in Palmer. Kohlberg, who's mayor of the Matsu Borough, plans to resign from that part-time office within a reasonable time and before the end of his term in 2012. Kohlberg says it was Chancellor Fran Ulmer's preference that he step down, and he agreed that would be the best. He will begin with the college on August 16th. Kohlberg was then Governor Sarah Palin's attorney general and a central figure in the legislature's investigation into her firing of her public safety commissioner. The search for a new Matsu Borough manager has produced a list of 42 applicants. Longtime Borough Manager John Duffy left the post last month, and the Borough is looking for a replacement. Acting Borough Manager Elizabeth Gray says the position is open until filled, and the Borough is still accepting applications. She says it's up to the Assembly to decide whether or not to hire a new manager before the October elections, in which Matsu voters will decide if they want to change the way the Borough is managed. Currently, a borough manager oversees the borough's day-to-day operations. Assemblyman Mark Ewing proposed in May that the borough should switch to a strong mayor form of government where the mayor would play a larger role in daily business decisions of the borough. Anchorage's economy is strengthening and gradually emerging from the national and international recession. And according to the analysis from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation presented this week, the city should see job growth by next year, KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to AEDC's President Bill Popp, there's some good news nestled within this year's employment drop. 2010 doesn't seem to be as bad as expected. In January, the corporation predicted an overall loss of about 1,200 jobs in Anchorage. Now, based on preliminary numbers through June, the expectation is for a yearly loss of 500 jobs. If so, that will be less than the previous year's approximately 900 job drop. Pop says Anchorage's job market is starting to edge upward.
AEDC believes Anchorage should see a return to job growth later this year. And modest annual job growth is projected to continue through 2013, reaching new record all-time levels for total employment in our community.
Pop offered the corporation's mid-year forecast update and three-year economic outlook yesterday to a packed luncheon crowd at Anchorage's Dena'ina Center. The data and resulting predictions were the work of AEDC's research team from the McDowell Group. In 2009 and so far in 2010, Anchorage's healthcare industry continues to show employment increase, as does the government sector. That trend buffers somewhat the city's overall job loss and is expected to extend into the future. Anchorage's air cargo sector, which took a big hit not only from the international recession but even redoubt volcano activity, is now showing significant signs of recovery.
The first 2 months of 2010 were up 30% over the first 2 months of 2009, months unaffected by redoubt. Another developing trend contributing to air cargo volumes is the significant increase in outbound air cargo from the U.S. to Asia.
The Port of Anchorage is showing signs of a healthy recovery after dropping significantly in 2009. However, the visitor industry, which depends largely upon discretionary funds and hinges on the national and international economy, is only slightly better than last year and hardly robust. Venturing into the volatile world of oil, AEDC predicts generally rising prices up to a little over $90 a barrel by 2013. Finally, increasing population, especially through domestic and international immigration, generally indicates an economy at least better than others. In that area, Anchorage should soon hit a milestone.
We project stronger than average growth for the next 2 years as a result of a shaky national recovery. And in 2011, Anchorage total population, and I'm amazed I'm saying this, will surpass the 300,000 milestone.
The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation predicts that by 2013, over 307,000 people will live in Anchorage. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A week after a fire destroyed a sawmill in Hoonah, its owners say they hope to resume full operation as soon as possible.
I like what I'm doing, so we want to keep pushing forward. We just think that there's a lot of great possibilities with the products that can be made out of the wood around here, and we want to just keep making that a reality.
That's Wes Tyler of Icy Straits Lumber and Milling, who acknowledges that it's a tough business to be in, especially with the current economy. He says they're trying to find a replacement sawmill. Tyler says it'll likely be smaller but more efficient and still able to do round log breakdown work.
We just need to be able to break down a log into square parts, and from the various sizes of square parts, we make all the finished products that we make. So it'll fit in really well.
After he secures financing, Tyler would like the sawmill on site by the end of August. The previous sawmill was valued at about $800,000. Tyler says insurance will barely cover the loan on the destroyed building. All the other facilities, the generator, planer, and air-drying sheds, and molder and dry kiln, were untouched by the fire that started the morning of July 22nd. The inventory was also unaffected.
The smaller dimensions and things and sizes that we would normally run in for resawing and drying and then making into various products, the siding, paneling, decking, just different things, those different kinds of things.
Tyler says he has 12 employees. Most will be able to stay busy in the meantime with secondary manufacturing. The state fire marshal believes that something ignited the sawdust inside the building, triggering a series of explosions that destroyed the sawmill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The state has patched up a damaged bridge on the McCarthy Road. The Department of Transportation reports that the Lahaina Bridge is passable again. Overhead supports on the steel span were hit by an oversized vehicle earlier this week, and the state closed the bridge after computer models revealed structural concerns. Bailey says emergency actions were taken.
Sent people from Bridge Design in Juneau directly to Lahaina Bridge, and they were able to make a temporary repair.
The Lahaina Bridge, which is about 15 miles outside McCarthy along the community's only road link, is open daily between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. until a permanent fix is completed. DOT personnel are on site making sure only vehicles weighing under 6,000 pounds cross the compromised span. Bailey says no decision has been made on whether the driver of the vehicle that hit the Lahaina Bridge will be held responsible for repair costs. It's not often that a cruise ship loses its anchor, but one was recovered on yesterday from the waters near Sitka. And as KCAW's Lily Mahalik reports, retrieving an anchor from the bottom of the sea is far from simple.
60 tons or 20,000 pounds of anchor and chain were recovered from the waters just beyond Sitka's Crescent Harbor. The anchor was dropped on May 20th by the MS Amsterdam cruise ship, which frequents Sitka Sound as it travels to and from Seattle and Anchorage. I spoke with Fred Reeder, the port director for Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska, who explained how the anchor was lost.
They had some trouble lowering it, and it just spooled off. They couldn't break it. They couldn't stop it. And it's supposed to stop at the end, but that part gave way, and they spooled off the anchor and about 1,200 feet of chain. And each link of the chain is about 20 inches long and weighs 180 pounds.
The lost anchor and chain were valued at $250,000 to $500,000. Reeder says Holland America decided to recover the lost items, thinking it would be more cost-effective and safer for other cruise ships mooring in the Sound. All in all, the recovery is slated to cost upwards of $100,000, and Reeder says finding and pulling such a big hunk of metal up from the depths is more complicated than you might think.
It took a while. The ship had a GPS position on where they were, but as you can imagine, it's a big body of water, and we drug around and couldn't find it by dragging for the chain and the anchor. So then we brought in some divers from Seattle, from Ballard Diving, and they came in. And what exacerbated the problem was that the anchor and chain was in just a little over 200 feet of water. So it makes for some extreme diving conditions.
The divers used a special mixture of helium and oxygen and had only 35 minutes to secure a line to the lost chain.
We have a yarder, which used to be used in the woods, yarding trees out of the forest. We've got it mounted to the deck of our barge. And then we also have a 110-ton crane on board. And we start pulling with one combination and then holding with another and then picking with the crane. And we'll pick the chain up to a height of about 90 feet, which is one shot of chain. And then we dog that off, and then we lower that chain down onto the deck of the barge.
Once the chain and anchor were on board the barge saddled up to the Amsterdam to relink the chain to its housing on the ship, where it was then reeled in. Bill Sharp is the vice president of port operations for Holland America and says this is the first ship he knows of to lose its anchor in Southeast, and that repairs to the anchor braking system were made shortly after the anchor was lost. The Amsterdam set sail from Sitka at 5 p.m. on Thursday with both the recovered anchor and a backup on board. Reporting in Sitka, this is Lily Mihalik.
A Talkeetna man is organizing an unusual worldwide conference taking place this weekend in Golden, Colorado. Alaskans from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Fairbanks, and other areas are participating in the discussion of dealing with human waste in remote areas. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
A Denali climbing ranger has been working on organizing a conference for years on dealing with human waste in the wilderness. It might have started over 30 years ago as Talkeetna resident Roger Robinson did his first climb on Denali when trash and human waste was a significant problem.
From my first year here in 75, trying to do cleanup wherever you poked, you found garbage. You know, and we didn't think of a lot about human waste back then. It was just the trash everywhere, just trash everywhere you looked on the mountain. It was just gross.
Years ago, Denali began their Clean Mountain Can operation, mostly due to the efforts of Robinson. Every climber is now required to carry the portable waste system up Denali and bring it back to civilization instead of leaving all their waste on the mountain. Robinson began to ponder how he could reach out to other wilderness managers around the world in helping them figure a method to better control their sanitation issues.
The last 3 years I've been working on it pretty steady. Went over to Japan in the fall of 08 and went to a big conference, international conference held by mountaineers around the world. And I gave a couple little short PowerPoints about what we've done here at Denali. And at that time, I was talking about exit strategies.
The conference is for managers and scientists trying to find the best way to deal with large amounts of people in wild areas.
The title, Managing Human Waste in the Wild, it doesn't necessarily mean wild means remote. Not necessarily wilderness per se, but places that may have some rough trail that comes into them, or trails that are heavily used, but places that there's, you know, on weekends there may be hundreds of people that, you know, walk out to some of these places and have to go.
Initially, the idea was to have it in Alaska. However, Robinson says Alaska as a location for a worldwide conference would be cost prohibitive. The American Alpine Club near Denver, Colorado, seemed a more likely location. He says it's been difficult to get people from Kenya and other locations to the conference. Visas and plane tickets are costly and difficult to obtain for people that rarely travel. And he's working on a no net loss system.
When a dollar comes in, then I can spend the dollar. I can't spend money ahead, so I have to generate the money before it can be spent.
People from around the globe are attending the conference and presenting. The hope is that everyone will learn from each other and take away ideas that will help them better manage their park or wilderness area. 11 countries plus the United States are involved and participating in the conference held at the American Alpine Club and American Mountaineering Center in Colorado. In Talkeetna, this is Sue Dio.
The Yukon Quest will offer a $150,000 purse for the 2011 race. The prize money is on par with what's been paid out the last 2 years. Quest Alaska Executive Director Marty Sturey says the race organization is announcing the purse earlier than normal in anticipation of the August 7th opening day of musher signups.
It's that time of year where rumors are starting to fly all over the place, and that's why we're trying to put out some of our information so that people know and can make good decisions on what they want to do with their future.
Sturey says maintaining the purse is challenging and that the Quest is keeping the entry fee at $1,500.
We understand that even though times are economically tough for us and we could use some more money, we also realize that all of our mushers are having a tough time getting sponsors as well. So we did not raise the entry fee, and we will put on more fundraisers or do whatever we have to do to offset our additional costs.
All mushers who sign up either in person on August 7th at the Fairbanks or White Horse Quest offices or by that date through the mail are entered into a drawing that refunds $1,000 to one lucky musher. There are a few changes that will take effect for the 2010 Quest. Veteran mushers will no longer have the option of getting dogs checked pre-race by their own veterinarians. Sturey says rookie and veteran teams will be examined by Quest vets a couple of days before the start.
Each musher will have the privilege to meet each of the veterinarians that's volunteering this year, and each veterinarian in turn will be able to meet each musher and each dog.
Sturey says the change is in response to Quest mushers as a way to jumpstart the relationship with race vets. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Adam Kame in Dillingham, Rosemarie Alexander and Matt Miller in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lily Mahalik in Sitka, and Sue Dio and Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.